Hello and welcome. You're listening to the Kraz Files podcast with Mr. Kraz and Garth. It's Thursday, the 26th of March 2015. If folks would like to get this podcast, it's available from iTunes, so you can download and subscribe over at iTunes. And you can also get this podcast from podomatic.com. Look for the Kraz Files, or C-R-A-Z-Z. And some of our podcasts are also available from Spreaker.com. You can check out our YouTube channel. Some of the podcasts are up there, just the Kraz Files on YouTube. And also we're up on Facebook. Lots of stories going up there. That's the Kraz Files, and also the same over at Twitter. And you can also send us an email to thekrazfiles at yahoo.com.au. And thanks, everybody, whoever you are, for listening to our podcast. Okay, Garth, we're all plugged in, ready to go, and we are going to wind down with Dr. Penny Sartori. Penny, thanks for being on the Kraz Files podcast.
Oh, thank you. It's lovely to be here.
It's great to have you, and as Garth said, we've been looking at your work, and I have your book. I'm about halfway through. I haven't finished it yet, but really wowed me. It's such a great book, because... Garth and I have been talking about this for a while now, and we talked to Barry Eaton, didn't we, Garth, about,
yes.
and Michael Horn, so many people about this, but Penny's book is, your book, Penny, is very different, indeed, just from the level you're at and you're being a nurse and everything. It really knocked me back a little bit, actually, but yes. I'm thoroughly enjoying this book, and it's so great that you... You offered it up on Kindle as well, because I heard a talk with you and I went and got it straight away. And it's a beautiful book already, and I'm only about halfway through. So you must be really thrilled to get that out to the public.
I was, yes. It took a long time, really, because I started it a few years ago, and then the publishing process is really slow, and I didn't realize that. So it took me a few years before it actually did come out. So it was great when it did, you know, and I've had such a huge positive response to it, which has been really encouraging. So I'm really glad that I did it.
Yeah, people all around the world contacting you, I guess. I guess they, why wouldn't they? I mean, it's an amazing, amazing concept. It's something that so many people ignore. I mean, we're all going to die, and so many people sort of just walk through this life and choose to ignore something that's inevitable. And, you know, but then you get the other side of the coin where you write this book and so many people are interested as well. So it's it's a real strange society out there.
Yes.
Yeah, well, I guess it is, because, you know, so many people fear death, but it seems that there's no fear. There shouldn't be any fear of death. And I think, as you know, in my, I don't think I fear death. The only thing I fear about death is probably the pain and suffering of dying. But death itself, the closing of your life or your physical life on this planet. Okay, well, you know, it's not going to go on forever. We all know that. But, you know, I'd hate what I don't – when I see these people suffering right up to the day they die, this is what worries me.
Depends on your body, Garth. This is an important part of we could sort of reconnect this to Penny's book as well, and looking after your body, because it is your vessel, isn't it, Penny, in this lifetime? And I don't think you need to be old and suffering, Garth. I think the hospitals, we have a big problem even in Australia, Penny, because of an elderly population progressing. And not enough people having kids, I guess, and the system is kind of crumbling a little bit. And I guess for a lot of elderly people who have lost loved ones or don't have any family to take care of them or any money, they get put into hospitals. And I've seen documentaries on it where they're put in cots with their knuckles dragging along the ground, you know, and they're not taken care of. And that's a sad thing, you know, for people, which is what you touch so much. That's the... my favourite part of your book at the moment, Garth, because Penny's sort of looking into this deeper, more spiritual respect and care for elderly patients, not just slapping morphine on them and shoveling them into a ditch, you know. We need to care more for our elderly people. And nurses like yourself, Penny, they're just so vitally important. We have a big problem in Australia where a lot of nurses are standing up and they're in a big battle with the government now to protect their rights. And a lot of them do go to England as well and go offshore, and we lose our nurses, and it's such a vital, important part of our care system, you know?
Yes, a lot of them are under the control of the doctors. I just wanted to ask Penny this. About 3 years ago, Penny, my mother died. She was 97, and she was deaf. And she was almost blind, and she was suffering from a cancer on her leg. It got to the stage where she was with us, where I live, and we're about 35 minutes from the nearest town. And the nurses were great. They were coming out and they were treating her, but it got to the stage where they said, we can't go on any further because the cancer is getting worse. Anyway, cut a long story short, I put her into the town's old age centre, and she had to go to intensive care. But the interesting side of this was that I left instructions that she wasn't to be given drugs, because I know what my mother was like. She was the older style, and she only took herbs and stuff like that, and other things. And I think a Bex was about the strongest thing she ever took with a cup of tea. But once again, to cut a long story short, I went in there one day and she was hallucinating. So I went up to the desk and I said, well, has there been a change in the medication? And they said, well, we're giving her morphine. And I said, well, you never spoke to me about it. And that was my instructions, that she was not to be given anything without them telling me.
Yeah.
Anyway, after that, she started to decline very quickly. And anyway, I went in there a couple of weeks after that, and the matron said to me that my mother was dying and she just couldn't get over the – she was dying but coming back all the time.
Right.
And this was fascinating because I'd never been involved with that. And I said, what do you mean dying and coming back? She said, well, she doesn't want to die. She's going there, but she's coming back all the time.
She's a strong woman. Yeah, I was there a couple of weeks before, guys. She was talking to people and pointing straight through me, which is in Penny's book, which a lot of people maybe they would just scratch up to being on morphine, but I don't think so, as you say in your book, Penny. There's something else going on that needs to be looked at. We're not looking at this. We're just putting it off as, oh, this person's going to die. They're talking to people, you know. It's nothing. So the nurses aren't trained, are they?
Yeah,
No.
That's right, absolutely. And it's not in the education of nurses or doctors, and it really should be, because these are very important aspects of the dying process. And rather than dismiss these experiences as being merely hallucinations or side effects of the drugs, it's very important that we do acknowledge them, because that can in itself help the person make that transition into death. So it's very important that we do take notice of them and not just kind of dismiss them. So it is very important.
Mm. Yeah. Why don't we just go back a little bit, Penny, and tell us a bit about yourself. I'm just on your website now, Dr. Penny Sartori, and it's just saying that you worked as a nurse in a British hospital for 21 years and 17 of those, as we know, being in intensive care. My goodness, the things you would have seen. Unbelievable.
Oh, yeah.
17 years in intensive care. So,
that's incredible. Yeah.
You went in, I like in your book, because you just give that personal experience as well as being a rookie and a nurse and going into this sort of situation. So just walk us through a little bit about your experiences there, how you came to do that and be a nurse and where you're at now.
Right, well, part of my training, I kind of had been to the intensive care unit. So then afterwards, when I qualified, I did a course where I spent some time in various different departments of the hospital. But I really enjoyed the intensive care aspect because, you know, it was really kind of exciting. And I went back there and I stayed there for 17 years. But it was very early on in my career as a nurse where my perception of what I was doing as a nurse changed greatly. And when I first started in intensive care, I really thought this was great, that I was saving people's lives. But then I had an experience where I was looking after a man who was clearly dying. And he had been a patient in intensive care for 14 weeks. And I looked after him during a night shift. And as I was undertaking some routine nursing care, I adjusted the side of the bed, the height of the bed, and the poor man nearly jumped out of bed in agony. And at that point, I looked at him and our eyes connected. And something happened, and it's as if I'd swapped places with him. So I could feel what he was going through and I could understand his frustrations. And he couldn't talk because he was connected to a ventilator via a tracheostomy. But he was mouthing the words to me, "Leave me alone, let me die in peace, let me die." And that had a huge, profound effect on me. And all of a sudden I thought, I'm not saving this man's life. I'm contributing to a really prolonged and slow, horrible death. And I couldn't get that patient off my mind. It really upset me. The following day, I went home and I couldn't sleep after my night shift. So I phoned work about mid-morning to find out how he was doing. And my colleague said that he'd actually died 2 hours after I'd left my work. And so that really sort of started me questioning my role as a nurse. And it also made me think, what happens when we die? And I thought, we don't really understand death at all. And so I thought I could do some courses maybe which would help me to care for these patients dying in a critical care area. But there was nothing available. All of the courses were palliative care, which have a very different approach to critical care. And so I thought, right, well, I've got two choices. I can either leave nursing and walk away from it, or I can try and do something about it. So I started reading about death, and then I came across near-death experiences. And I thought, you know, these are really fascinating things. These people who have temporarily died and returned to life because they've been resuscitated have said that they've had this wonderful experience and all pain disappears. And it's just such a lovely experience that they want to stay there. And I think I was really quite sceptical in the beginning because my training as a nurse was very scientific. But then the more I thought about these experiences, the more curious I became, and I started asking questions to patients who I'd been looking after. And I thought, well, I'm in the ideal place to do my own research into this. And that's where I decided that's where I would go with my work, really. So it all started from that experience of looking after a man who was dying. And I think the fact that I did my research as well, I think that was that really helped me to see things from a different perspective then when I worked as a nurse in intensive care. And I think it was almost as if it helped me to deal with all the death that I saw as well. Mm. Because I didn't see that death as being a defeat anymore. I just understood it as being a very natural process. that we're all going through.
Yeah, as I've said before, we don't accept it though. We sort of, especially people, they get married and have a family and kids, and they just sort of shut it out, like it's never going to happen. You know,
is there a sequence, or is it just something that just happens?
There is a sequence. There's various different aspects of the dying process. So you can look at as people are terminally ill, and especially in the week or so, or a few days before they actually do die, people tend to see deceased relatives or friends. And again, you know, because we're not exposed to these things regularly, a lot of people think that they're just hallucinations, and they may also begin talking symbolically, like they talk about packing a suitcase or going on a journey or waiting for a train, things like that. There's all these little subtle signs which kind of symbolize that death is kind of imminent. And there was some research done, this was back in the 1970s, by Ossis and Haraldson. And what they found is that in the two or 3 days before people actually died, they started hallucinating, well, not hallucinating, but seeing visions of deceased relatives.
Oh, are they tapping into that part of the brain that the DMT or psychedelics like ayahuasca or even marijuana taps, is that a similar sort of connection that they're making in that moment, Penny?
Yes, it could well be. And that's the thing, you see, because we don't understand consciousness. And no. That's one of the biggest things that my research has taught me, really, how we don't understand consciousness. And I think when we look at these experiences from the perspective which is current in our science, our current science believes that the brain creates consciousness, so that when the brain stops functioning, that consciousness dies. But research into near-death experiences is showing that consciousness is heightened during a near-death experience. It's not dulled down, as you would expect of a dysfunctional brain. So I think what we need to do is start to consider consciousness as being mediated through the brain, not created by it. So then at times then when people approach death, as the brain is dying, I think the brain acts like a kind of filter, and it filters out this consciousness which is around us all the time. And then there are times in our life, as you approach death, maybe during a near-death experience, where that filter action relaxes. And so rather than this experience being created, it's merely allowed into everyday consciousness. And I think that explains these experiences far better. So again, when people take these drugs such as ayahuasca or LSD, what they're doing is relaxing that filter action of the brain so that this heightened state of awareness can be allowed into the everyday experience.
So what you're saying is that consciousness is totally separate to the brain.
Well, I think it's difficult to say, really, and we need to do a lot more research into it. But I think it makes more sense to me to consider consciousness everywhere, all around us, in us, around us, everywhere. And I think it's mediated through the brain so that we get varying different experiences of consciousness according to the brain, really, and how the brain is functioning.
Because when a person dies and the brain goes out, consciousness remains, doesn't it?
Well, that seems to be the case with people, and particularly in cases where there's been a cardiac arrest. There should be no brain function, but clearly some people have reported a heightened state of awareness. Some of them have even gained information that they were unaware of previously, and some of them have had like an out-of-body experience where they have very accurately described the events that were going on at the time. So I think we really do need to revise our understanding of consciousness and not limit it to being produced by the brain.
Or not controlled by religions.
Yes.
Seems to be a spark there, Garth, at the moment of death, where this consciousness gets sparked. As Penny said, it just seems to be all around. But I don't know if you could use the word connected. It just seems to be one, Penny, maybe. And then there's just this spark that sets off this light. So it's an amazing... an amazing thing to look into. It's just, I mean, we can't cover your work in an hour that we're going to have you, but we can go through it and discuss it. because it's such an important subject, you know.
Well, there's so many people, you know, Dr. Penny, that have these near-death experiences and are so happy.
Yes, when they don't want to come back, Garth. So many.
There's actually been documented cases where people have been resuscitated and they've been really angry at being resuscitated.
Cranky.
But it's, that'd probably be me, Dr. Penny.
Yeah, he's a cranky.
But anyway,
as I said, Dr. Penny, it's your book, by the way, is The Wisdom of Near-Death Experiences and How Understanding Near-Death Experiences Can Help Us Live More Fully. And you've hit the nail on the head there. And Garth and I sort of have gone through this before, that we're sort of living in a society or a world, if you will, of fear. And I feel personally, I know it's negative to say, but we have to get into the negative to discover the positive. And I feel like, you know, death has been demonized, especially through the movies. All these horror movies and terrible culture that our young people, the video games, just, you know, where they're just shooting people in the head and the blood and the gore. It's, you know, it just desensitizes people. And I feel like people are losing their empathy through this, you know. And it's almost like a lot of people are just stumbling through this life into a grave with an atheist outlook. And I feel like, because in your book you do talk about, I actually picked up a couple of books the other day from a fair. One was The Truth in the Light by Peter Fenwick and Elizabeth Fenwick. It's an investigation, Garth, of over 300 near-death experiences. But also one I'll talk to you about now is Beyond the Darkness. My near-death journey to the edge of hell and back, Angie Fenimore. I haven't read these books, but this woman had a particularly nasty experience, which you go through in your book. And Garth, I haven't read many books like that. Penny touches both sides. People do have negative experiences. Do you think this is because, Penny, they're carrying a sort of a negative life experience or into the next life, or when they die, they're dying in a fear state, maybe? Because I'm sort of gathering that if you die in a fear state or you know, with that tense hanging on of fear that it's going to be a bad thing, and you're so scared, you know, it might draw on negative experiences at first, until the person after death can maybe recognize that it's not a bad thing. And so let us know a little bit about those experiences you talk about in your book, about these darker experiences that people have, because we're all humans. It's very interesting.
That's right, it is. And the distressing kind of experiences are far more difficult to research, because people don't want to talk about these. There's various different reasons why. So there's some stigma involved with it, and some people think, well, everyone talks about such a pleasant experience, but I had this frightening experience. I'm not going to talk about that in case they think I'm a bad person. And the research that we do know of, it doesn't have any bearing on the person's moral character at all. And in fact, you know, a lot of people have said to me, well, do you think it's people who are bad people who have these really bad experiences? And there's no evidence to support that at all.
Yeah.
You know, the good experiences happen to bad people, and the bad experiences happen to good people. So, you know, none of that sort of no conclusions there from that aspect. But one thing that has been suggested is that people who are used to being in control in their life, and all of a sudden they're thrown into this near-death experience and they're losing control on life. And it seems that the people who are clinging on to life are, in some way, it can turn into a distressing experience. And when they relax into it and let go of trying to gain that control, it seems to change into a pleasant experience as well. But then again, there are some people who have had really distressing, hell-like experiences who would even disagree with that as well. So I think that we really need to do a lot more research into the experiences. And so far, the way that they've been sort of categorized is in four different ways. The first one is where people have the usual near-death experience, but they interpret it in a very unpleasant or distressing way. The second type is called the void experience, and this is where the people find themselves in a black and dark, meaningless, eternal void. And one lady described her experience of this as being eternal boredom. It was the same thing replaying over and over again, and she felt that she was looking at a roll of paper which was just replaying all the time. And then you've got the third type, which is the actual hell-like experience, where people do feel that they're either looking into hell or they're in hell, and they can feel the flames of hell, they can feel demons trying to drag them down. And then there's the fourth kind of experience, where people feel that they're very distressed by reliving their life review. It really frightens them.
So is that dimensions, Penny? Are you talking about maybe dimensions there, where depending on the person's state of mind, they're going to maybe lower level frequency type dimensions to sort of work their way out and to go up to higher dimensions? Is this a dimensional thing, do you think, after death?
I'm not sure, to be honest with you. We really don't know, and we can't answer those questions at present. So, you know, we need to gather more of these cases. But the thing is as well, is that the recall of these experiences can be so distressing that people actively try and block them out. So it's very difficult then for people to kind of share their experiences so that we can research them further.
Yeah,
so it's a bit of catch-22.
That becomes like some people, you know, when they have things bad happen to them in their childhood.
Yes.
You know, if they were molested or something, and they bottle it down and they put it way deep down. And this is the same sort of thing. They have a terrible sort of experience. And you know, it's a hard... I mean, it must be hard for these people. They've died and come back, but had a bad experience as well. And then they've put that down, deep down inside themselves as well. To live their lives, so it must be a stressful thing as well for them.
It is very, very stressful. And in fact, you know, after I got into my my research, I then reflected back on a case of when I was a student nurse, and I remember this case very vividly. And it was a lady who was dying, and she knew she was dying, but she was terrified. She was really, really frightened. And I can remember she used to try and climb out of bed. And every time the nurses passed by her bed, she would grab onto their uniform, grab onto their arms, and dig her nails into their flesh. And in an attempt to set, and she would look into your eyes and say, "Please don't let me die." And she was terrified. And she said, "I've died before and I don't want to die again." And none of us understood it. And I can remember we chatted with her family, and the family said, well, she had a cardiac arrest about 5 years ago. And of course, at the time, I'd never heard of near-death experiences. But now, having the benefit of doing this research, I'm wondering if when that lady had a cardiac arrest, she had a hell-like distressing experience,
yes,
which was then affecting her, making that transition into death.
Yeah.
So I think it's so essential that we look at these experiences, learn what we can from them, so that we can use that to benefit future patients as well, so that they don't have to go through such a distressing time.
Mm. Yes, that makes a lot of sense, doesn't it?
Yeah.
Because a lot of people, they go through it, they've actually died, and then they get sent back.
Yes.
That is so amazing how you describe that in your book, Penny, how these people just kind of float through these tunnels and they can see that light. It's like in one of those dreams where you're sort of running but you're in mud, or you just can't get to where you want to go, you know. But some of them pass through quite quickly into these amazing sort of areas, and then they can be presented with deceased relatives or even pets, things like this, which is an amazing thing. Is this? I mean, what do you think about this, Penny? When people have a near-death experience and they're presented with dead relatives and this type of thing, how do we categorize this? Where do we put this this experience that they're having? It's such a remarkable thing. I know, because we're living now and we're flesh and bone and we're alive. It's hard to sort of make that connection, but it's such an incredible piece of the puzzle to try and put together that this is happening to people. And then these relatives, Garth, they're sort of telling them, sometimes I got from your book, they've sort of got a choice. Do you want to keep going forward or go back? And some of their relatives actually tell them it's not your time. And then they head backwards, back through where they've come from, back down through the roof into their bodies, Penny.
Yes, that's right. And the interesting thing about this is that some people meet relatives who they didn't know to be dead at the time of the experience as well. So a lot of people have said to me, well, isn't that just wishful thinking? Wouldn't we all wish to see our dead relatives come to welcome us? But then when they see report on relatives who they didn't know to be dead, that factor can be taken out of it as well. And also, sometimes they can have communication with these dead relatives, and they can gain information that they couldn't have done through the senses. Now that is really interesting to me.
I see.
And there was one man in my hospital research. During his near-death experience, he had communications with a dead family member, and she said to him, "You have to go back now. You're the head of the family. But when you return, can you give this message to your daughter?" So when he did revive, his daughter visited him, and he gave her this message. And she was absolutely astounded that he should know this information, because it was something that she'd gone through to great lengths to keep a secret from him. So how do we explain that? How did he gain that information while he was unconscious? It really kind of doesn't make sense. So that's a really interesting aspect to me.
Is the I mean, I guess these people that present themselves like, say, for example, relatives in the afterlife to that person, it seems like, is it something like is are we looking at, for example, energy sort of putting on a suit of what that person remembers or wants to see? Are they showing us sort of what we want to see visually, but they're really part of this energy source, you know? I mean, that's the sort of what I was wondering.
Yeah, that could well be the case,
I
absolutely.
guess what you
And
were saying before as well, Penny, with people having bad experiences and some people seeing God and people with long beards and white robes and they're seeing the devil. Are they seeing what they believed in this life? Is it just being shown to them what they believe their entire life? Because I guess if you're extremely, extremely religious your whole life and you die, you know, you're probably going to see that.
Well, yeah, that's right. And, you know, these experiences are very culturally influenced as well. So, you know, people in the East are more likely to see images of Hindu deities, whereas in the West, they're more likely to see images of Jesus. So I think it's a lot of symbolic imagery that we're used to from our upbringing. But it's almost as if when they access this altered state of consciousness, they're tapping into like an archetypal realm. So, for example, Carl Jung talked about archetypes and the collective unconscious, where there are these images in the collective unconscious which stem from our ancestors and everything, and all thoughts and consciousness from the whole of mankind as well, not just the individual. So it seems like during their experience, these people are tapping into this collective unconscious as well, and interpreting the symbols which are inside that collective unconscious as well. So I guess, you know, it makes sense then that you would interpret them according to your culture as well.
Yeah,
Interesting
that's
stuff.
getting a bit,
Well,
that's getting deep, isn't it?
Michael Horn said that, Garth. We talked to American guy Michael Horn about the Billy Meier case. There's some interesting parts of it, but he was saying that when you die, it's not good to be cremated because the energy released from your body, your soul, spirit, is still reabsorbing energy from your bones, so it's better to be buried, which was an interesting thing. I've never heard that before, Penny, but.
No.
You know, it's just absolutely amazing, and you know, I think it's so incredible what you're doing, you know, because being a nurse as well, it's something that's just lacking, isn't it? It's just really pitiful. You live in the UK, we're in Australia, and this isn't happening. This kind of care, Garth, for elderly people, which is really disgusting, considering the money we pay in our taxes, and it's just not happening. People are being abused in some of the homes here, Penny. Which is just, I've seen reports on it. People are going in with hidden cameras. They're being punched and kicked. And this is terrible. And you know, it's unbelievable. It really, really is disgusting. And
It
the people aren't having that care, that care that they need. I mean, you can imagine if you're, you know, imagine being, you know, married for 50, 60 years and living together with your loved one, and suddenly one day they're gone, you know, they've just vanished, and you're left alone, and you don't have family, and you end up in a place and the nurse is your best friend, and it's someone to be with you until your last breath and help you to pass over and make you feel good about yourself and positive that death isn't a bad thing and it isn't something to be feared.
That's right. I totally agree. You know, this is something that nurses have an ideal opportunity to make that transition into death very pleasant for someone. We're all going to die. But the thing is as well with the balance of that is that it's not in the education of nurses, certainly not in the UK anyway. They, you know, very small, maybe they may touch on these aspects, but it's not as big an aspect of their education as it should be. And I think we live in such a high technology society. Our technology is wonderful. You know, it's really kind of gone up the scale a huge amount in the last 20 years. But that's not been accompanied by an increase in understanding of the spiritual needs of patients as they're dying.
That's big, Dr. Penny.
Yeah,
yes,
we're becoming technology, Garth. And if that's happening, we're losing our empathy because we're not using technology properly.
Yeah, I found in the case of my mother was that the nurses were great. They really were caring and understanding. Where the problem came in was the management and the doctors. And that's what I felt. And I had a meeting there one day over the administration when they gave my mother morphine, and the head doctor came in and he couldn't answer my questions. And he couldn't get out of that room quick enough.
I bet, yeah.
Yeah, yeah, he just couldn't get out of that room. He didn't want to know me, to be quite honest.
Well, they also jabbed your mother, Garth, with a flu vaccine, which gave her shingles.
That's correct.
A lot of elderly people up in Garthway and around the country are getting shingles and these types of adverse reactions, Penny, from these vaccines, and they didn't even ask Garth. They just went and jabbed her with it. And then they were supposed to fix her eye with laser surgery, and they ruined her eye. And I think that really made her very upset, Garth, because she's a very independent lady and wanted to live alone. And this is something I very much believe in, Penny. I think that, you know, I think one thing in Australia they're trying to do is make it more easier for people to die at home, you know, to be at home, because I feel sorry. I mean, a lot of elderly people, they're comfortable in their house, you know. They don't want to be just dragged out and thrown in a hospital somewhere. And I don't understand why the government isn't pushing for more care so people can have a little apartment and they can be at home and die comfortably, you know. I mean, I just don't understand it. It's 2015.
That's right. And that would make so much more sense.
People are comfortable at home, Penny, and that makes them pass over better. Wouldn't you agree?
Absolutely.
And being in a foreign environment, you know?
Yes.
Well, in my experience with my mother, was the first experience I had. The nurses who came out here, and they had to travel a distance, and they were great. And the only problem they couldn't keep it up was that the cancer got beyond them.
Right.
And they couldn't make decisions. Uh-huh. So it had to be under the, had to be what they called intensive care, under the care of doctors. But the nurses up till then were absolutely fantastic.
Absolutely.
I just got to give them 100% because, you know, to come out here in the bush and apply that, and they, you know, and it's difficult because they had to bath her and treat her, and I give them 100%.
Our nurses here, Garth, are so good, and they deserve so much better than what they get from this government. And it's always been that way, Penny, and they're so good in Australia, our nurses. They just it's a real crying shame, as you said as well, that becoming a nurse, they're not indoctrinated into this as well. I mean, it's almost like if you go through to be a nurse and they teach people about near-death experiences, it's like, oh, this person's crazy, you know? It's like that can't be part of the system, can it, when it's an organic part of life.
Exactly. It's a really natural part of life, and yet we totally ignore it and consider it to be airy-fairy, as one of my colleagues at the School of Health Sciences said the other day. And it's not, you know. They've turned nursing into a very academic thing where it's all done at the university, and so they consider things like this to be non-academic, and so they don't even consider it as part of nurse training, which is absolutely ridiculous.
It's sterile, isn't it? Very cold and blunt in its approach, which is clear indication, Penny, that we're going the wrong way. I just don't understand it as you do. I can't understand it.
there's more nurses who are really interested in these experiences now, and there's a lot of them actually. I teach at the adult education department at the university, and I've noticed in recent months that there's more and more nurses starting to attend these courses as well. So the nurses want it in their education, and so I think it's really important that we do fight for this, and I'm hoping in the next few months that I'm going to be sort of doing something more proactively to get this into the nursing education.
Yes, that's well needed, isn't it? It certainly is, because particularly in this country, because we're an aging population, Dr. Penny, and this is why it's such an impact on the so-called medical, on the government for medicine, etc. But the problem is they're not approaching it in the right way, because we have Mr. Palmer in there, and all they're interested in is administering drugs to these older people when there's a better way of life than administering these stupid drugs that's not going to save their lives.
That's it.
All it's doing is creating problems.
Yeah, it's what was that? Yeah. Do you remember that study? It might have been done in the 70s or 80s, Penny, about where they I don't have it in front of me. I just remember looking into it because they redid it. It was where they took some, they took some elderly people who were almost in a vegetative sort of state in nursing homes, and they took them out and they put them in a house where they had to do their own chores and make their own meals. And that, did you see that study? It was quite an old study. And they started to get better and better and healthier and healthier. It was an amazing, I don't remember, I'll try and dig that up, but they redid it just a few years back, and they took these elderly people who are almost just vegetables lying in a bed, Garth, doing nothing, and not moving, and they put them in this house, and they had to make their tea and potter around and fix little cupboards and do things, and they became so much better than what they were. It was absolutely astonishing, and that's what I feel. I feel like a lot of elderly people are going in too early and just rotting away in there when there's so much more left in their lives. There's so much more potential there. And the medical system, Penny, the drug companies are only too happy to administer drugs when they don't really need it.
Of course, it's big profits in drugs, isn't it?
Yes. Vaccines especially. Yes. It's a crazy thing, It's I feel like my grandmothers did that a lot, Garth. They sort of just sat there, when they didn't need to. They should be out being active a lot more. A lot of elderly people are very active, Penny, into their 80s and 90s.
That's right.
There's nothing wrong with that. They shouldn't be in nursing homes on drugs. But as we know, there may come that time when they get quite old and they need some nursing care, and I can't understand why this has not happened. There's how much funding goes into the movies, Penny, and Hollywood and TV and sports and all this stuff the government throws around, money like it's nothing, but we can't put some money into our proper nursing of our elderly patients who are nearing death and going through that experience that we're all going to go through, and we're not learning from it either. We're just ignoring it.
Yeah, I know, and I think that's a really sad state of affairs, isn't it, the way it is? It's as if these things, you put it out of your mind, it's not going to happen to you, and other people don't matter, and that's the kind of attitude that it seems to be presented to us, and it's wrong, and we need to care for people at the end of their life in a really good way.
As you're saying, Dr. Penny, we could learn so much from it.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
You yourself, you've spent a lifetime in here, and the knowledge you've gained, imagine if that was across the board. I mean, for goodness sakes, there's so much for us to learn that we don't know.
And, it's a real privilege to be at the bedside of someone when they're dying as well. It really is. And over the years, I have learned so much from these people, and they really have been my greatest teachers. And I feel like because I've learned so much, it's really impacted on the way I live my life now. And it's made me more mindful of the way I live my life. And to be honest with you, I've never been happier, because a lot of people used to say to me, oh, you're morbid, you're studying death.
Exactly.
But I think, when you start to learn about death, that's when you really start to learn about life, and that is the most important thing.
Yeah.
Yes, that makes a lot of sense.
That's the problem, Garth, the demonization of death. And I hate to say it, Penny, I know a lot of people don't like this, but I myself lost a friend a while ago to a horrific death. I don't even want to talk about it. the way he died. And I went to the funeral, and it was just, it was very sad. And just sort of looking into it myself, the way that we deal with people when they die. And you look at different indigenous cultures from all around the world, whether it's the Amazon or it's in India, and they deal with it in different ways. But I feel like the way we deal with death a little bit in the West is a bit strange to me, because especially when we have open casket funerals, because if you ask most people about what's your greatest fear, a lot of them are going to say to you, being buried alive. You know, and that's the truth. And that's because, I don't know, I feel like a lot of people, when you have an open casket funeral and they mourn, and then they go and they see that body go down into the ground and the dirt go on top, they're associating, they're making a connection that that person that they knew is still in that body, but it's not. That body's finished, it's done its course, and that energy has moved on to a greater, even better, even more real experience than what we're doing right now talking to you.
Yes, absolutely, yes.
And I feel like that makes a lot of people feel, like, negative about death. And, you know, and I just feel like that's where we are now. It's people think of death, and as I said before, because of all the movies and stuff, it's like if someone dies, you know, they're going to be possessed, you know, and all this garbage that's coming out, you know. It's unbelievable, and, you know, I can understand. I really do, looking at your book, and from other research that I've done, that if people are going to die in feeling these types of things in a negative way, they may have a negative experience, but maybe at the end of the day, it's not really a negative experience, Penny, because we've talked to other people about this. It seems like very dark, negative people that maybe murdered other people or did terrible things in this life, they seem to die and go to low-level sort of frequencies, you know, like grey planes, like areas, like you said, that are full of boredom, like deserts of nothing, and they get stuck there to contemplate, you know, what they've done. And as Garth and I have talked about before, there's nothing worse for a person that's done evil deeds to have to face what they did. And feel it from the people that they hurt, to feel that hurt themselves, and that's the ultimate punishment, isn't it?
Absolutely, and that is a really big part of the near-death experience, and that is the life review, because the life review is not just kind of looking at what you've done in your life; it's actually reliving it. And sometimes you relive it from a third person perspective. So anyone that you've kind of interacted with. So if you've been unpleasant to someone, if you've been really nice to someone, it's as if you experience it from that person's point of view. And so if you've been violent to that person, you feel like what it's like to be on the receiving end of that violence. Conversely, if you've been really nice to someone, you can see the impact that your actions have on that person. But not only that, the far-reaching impact, because it goes on like a ripple effect. So those good actions will continue in ways that you will never know about. And so part of the life review is actually reliving that. And there's a really good example in David Lorimer's book, which came out in the 1980s. And it's of a prisoner. And he had this near-death experience. And he felt everyone that he had harmed during his life, he felt like what he was like to be on the receiving end of that. And when he revived, he had a complete turnaround of character, and he became a really loving person and completely changed the way that he had lived his life.
Is it that you know, what popped in my head then, Penny, A Christmas Carol, the Charles Dickens novel, where the vicious, mean old man gets taken by the ghost, to, you know, through his past to see how he's been acting, and then he becomes a better person. Same with Groundhog Day. You could look at it like that. Yeah, reviewing your past, reviewing what you've done, because it's fine to get away and hurt people and be a vicious, nasty human being, because you're not feeling those people's pain, you know. And when you get that life review, this is what I've read, Garth and Penny, many times. It's not just from Penny's work, it's over and over and over again, this life review there. It's amazing.
Well, you mentioned, Dr. Penny, the being of light. Is that all part of this?
Yes. Now, the being of light, in fact, with regards to the life review, sometimes the person is reviewing their life but they've got that being of light at the side of them. And it's really funny because that being of light, rather than judging them, the person themselves is judging themselves, but that being of light is acting as a source of comfort. So sometimes during the life review, if the person is having a hard time looking at those and experiencing the images, it's as if the being of light stops it for a while, comforts them, and then restarts it again. So that being of light is not judgmental, but is there to support the person through the experience as well. And this being of light kind of just emanates this unconditional love for the person, no matter what they've done.
Could that be associated with our alter ego, if you like, or this so-called angel that talks to us at times?
So higher dimensional self, Garth.
Yeah, higher dimensional self.
Intuition.
Yes, it could well be, We really don't know as such as yet, but that is certainly one possibility.
There is that.
Well, thank God, Dr. Penny, it's people like you that are going to promote this and get this out where people can discuss it. And this is what's needed.
It needs
to be talked about, and it needs to create a huge interest around the world so that we can all start talking about this without our horrid governments and pharmaceutical companies closing it all down, which they're doing.
There's just something, you get that feeling, Penny, there's something there that, I don't know, Garth and I call it a force. There's just something on this planet. There's some negative force behind the mirror of time, you know, that it doesn't want us to know something about ourselves. You know, it's like we talk about people are psychic and all this stuff, but we're all psychic. We're all special. We all have this ability to do these incredible things, and we're all so much more special than we think we are, but we're told we're not. And, you know, I always, this cause and effect thing, Garth, and I always talk about this. Well, why is it happening? Why is this negativity being passed on so to every single person's life, lifetime after lifetime? It's just an amazing thing, this horrid negativity that's always there. And you know, it disallows people to get on with their lives and be better people. It's like there's something there, Penny, that just doesn't want us to know who we really are.
That's it. And that's interesting, because after a near-death experience, when the people come back to life, that kind of negativity disappears, and the people are very empowered as a result of their experience as well. So it really, it's almost like it resets their consciousness, if you like. And so they start life again, you know.
Yeah. I mean, did you grow up thinking, Garth and Penny, did you grow up thinking that death was good? I always feared it. I guess it was because of the TV and the movies I watched mainly, but society around me and the general culture, but... it's weird to think that it's the exact opposite, but they're making you think that it's negative. So it's obviously, it's cause and effect. There's good and there's bad. It's all energy, Penny. But something here with us is tapping into the negative state of the energy force. And when people die, they're obviously getting a first look at this beautiful state behind the death experience.
Yes, that's right, absolutely. Everything is kind of stripped away, that all of the stuff that's been sort of, ingrained in them really throughout their life, it's all kind of stripped away, and it's as if they strip back to nothing, and then they see things from a completely different perspective. And it resets their consciousness in a very big and profound way. And, you know, that is followed through by their actions after their experience. You know, they completely change as human beings, and they're changed in many ways. You know, materialistic things are no longer of importance. Earning money and great sums of money, that's not of importance. It's simple things in life that they already have, but perhaps didn't appreciate so much, they start to really appreciate. So, you know, there's big life changes after the experience.
That's amazing.
And in fact, and because the experience can be so profound, in fact, there's quite a high divorce rate as well, because their spouses no longer recognize them anymore, and they have nothing in common after the experience. So,
Is that right?
Yeah.
Jeez, it's almost like a gift, though, Penny. It's almost like a gift for people, you know.
Yes.
As you said, that's very interesting what you said, because it resets their consciousness. which is almost like dying and having to come back again. But they've done that, but sort of almost cheated it in a way and had their consciousness, their whole outlook on life reset. So it's, you could look at it as a gift.
Yes, and that's what they do, you know, it is, it really is a gift. And what is interesting as well is that Professor Kenneth Ring did some studies in the 1980s, and he used to teach a course on near-death experiences to his students. And he did some surveys with his students, and he found that his students were changed very much in ways similar to people who'd had a near-death experience simply by learning about near-death experiences. So it has far-reaching effects. And certainly as a result of me undertaking my research, it's really changed me and my perspective on life as well in a very positive way. So I think if the whole world could be really open to these experiences and learn about them, we could all benefit from them without having to nearly die.
Yeah. Mm, yeah, that makes a lot of sense. It certainly does. Because, you know, when you look at our education, particularly in some of the religions where they teach us that we're born with original sin. So the moment we come out of our mother's womb, we're sinners.
Yeah. Well, it's fear, Garth. It's all fear.
Yeah, and that creates fear.
Yes, it's all fear. All of it. All of it that we've been talking about, the TVs, the movies, all of that, the religious doctrines, everything is fear. No matter what word you put on it, it all stems from fear, and fear's an energy. But it's all love. It's all love.
Yeah.
Okay, we're back. Sorry, a little bit of a lost you there, Penny. You're all the way over in Wales, aren't you?
Yes, I am, yes.
Ah, wow. Yeah, you have that... I love your accent. It's really, really nice. Yeah, yeah. You're a long way away, but sometimes we get that on Skype. But we're unfortunately, Penny, we only wanted to get you for an hour because you're so busy in your life. But why don't we talk about your book and promote that a little bit? And you were on with Anthony Peake as well, who we hope to talk to in a couple of weeks or maybe a month. He's a really nice guy. Yeah, I've read a couple of his books, and he got back to me and said he'd love to come on, and he's a bit busy. But I love that talk you did with him. And Anthony Peake, Garth, is someone who is like Penny. You know, they're doing this sort of stuff, but they're just stepping sideways, you know. They're just stepping out of the shadow and they're doing their own, walking their own path and creating another way. And it's so interesting. Anthony's an amazing, amazing guy. You know, that we're repeating this life over and over again. And obviously we're here to learn something, Penny. And I think what we're here to learn is to be better people. And I heard you say that, you know. Become better people in this life, and then we become better, and we're obviously progressing somewhere. Otherwise, we just keep coming back.
So that's right. Yeah.
Yeah, amazing thing. So, tell us a little bit about your book and how people can here in Australia, especially, we have a lot of listeners can contact you and get that book off you. And
Well, my book is called The Wisdom of Near-Death Experiences, How Understanding NDEs Can Help Us Live More Fully. And that's available on Kindle. And also, I guess you can get it on Amazon in Australia and bookshops as well, because I'm sure it's been published in Australia as well. So you should be able to get it through the bookstores as well. And I've also got a website, which is www.drpennysartori.com. I do have a blog, but I've not had time to get to the blog. I've been so busy this year. It's been really hectic year for me. So, and I'm, you know, there's lots of stuff online as well.
What's coming up for you?
There's going to be a lot more things that I'll be doing. I'm going to be interviewing a lot of people, and that's going to be going up on YouTube in the coming months. And I've got a lot of speaking events as well. In fact, I've got another one with Anthony Peake, and that's going to be in London on the 4th of May. And we're going to speak at the Mind Body Spirit Festival, which is going to be at Olympia in London. So that's something else for the future. There's a lot more speaking events, and I'm writing another book as well. So I'm in the middle of that at the moment.
That's great. So, do you have a podcast sort of link on your website where you put all your talks, or are you working on that?
I'm working on that. I've done so many, I really need to kind of get them on and link them all up now. So yes, that's what I need to do. I think that's going to be my friend's next job. I've got a good who sorts out my website for me. So
yeah, I can send you our talk now, but also you can record it on your end as well. But I'll send you the link after I upload it to our end.
Great.
But yeah, you can always put them up on your site as well. And there's YouTube and everything, and gets it out there, doesn't it?
That's right.
Are you on social media, Penny?
No, well, I'm on Twitter, but I'm not really sure how to use it, to be honest.
Yeah, it's something new to
me. That's exactly my problem.
I don't really like it, but we did it for the podcast, and we're just using Facebook as a website. Yeah,
Now, I haven't got a Facebook page yet, so that's another job that I need to do as well, so... Yeah, look out for that in the future.
Yeah, well, it's great speaking to you. And I think, Penny, I hope people can listen to this and listen to you and read your book and start to become more open-minded, you know?
Yeah,
it's an important thing. I mean, you know, imagine having a dream, Penny, and not being able to wake up from it and having dreams within dreams. It'd be like a room of broken mirrors. You know, so what makes this life so real? I mean, if you die and you have an afterlife experience and these people are saying that I don't want to come back to this life, then, you know, and I mean, what's real? What's not? You know, I mean, maybe this is all part of something and this is a dream. We don't really know. So we need to start relaxing, Penny, and start taking it easy and looking at this stuff and just calming down as human beings. People are so fidgety. They're fidgeting like schizophrenic monkeys, Penny, on their iPhones and their gadgets and their bits and pieces, and they're rushing through life and they're not even stopping to take a breath and look up at the sky and just relax a little bit and not be in such a fear state. Because when you're living a stressful life, you're living in a fear state. And it's, you know, you need to just calm down a little bit and go and take it easy. Because we need to enjoy our lives, don't we, Penny?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. And I think, you know, take some time out, contemplate your own mortality and what that means to you, and then everything can really change and you can live a very empowered life as a result. So it's important that you think about your own death.
Everything will fall into place.
Yes.
Anything you want to finish on, Gav?
No, the only thing I'm going to do is get into Dr. Penny's book. I've been going to do that for a number of weeks now, but I just haven't had the time. But I certainly will be now that I've spoken with her and with you, Dr. Penny, and maybe next time round I'll understand a little bit more about it.
Uh-huh.
Yeah,
and that'll be interesting because we'd love to get you on again.
Yeah, we will.
Yeah,
we will.
That would be great. I'd be very happy for that. Yes.
Yeah, we'll keep in touch. And our podcast goes around the world. A lot of people in America listen, and we have a lot of listeners in the UK now. And all over, so it's a good thing doing a podcast. It's sort of like the new media, Penny, you know?
Yes,
it's something that people enjoy and they can do at home. We can talk to you at home and you're comfortable, and it's a nice thing. So we'd like to talk to you again, and of course I'll keep in touch to see how you are and as you get close to writing your next book, if there is anything you want to tell us about, we can get you on and put it out there. But it's been great speaking to you and your I think I did forget to sort of ask you that you know, how your life's changed. It must be just incredible, but it must be an amazing experience for you to just be going this way and then just be shifted that way, and I just wondered how you saw the world now, how you see things around you so different, because it's almost like you've had a near-death experience going through this with the people. You've learned so much. It's and it's now it's become your life. So
exactly. If I hadn't done my research, I think I'd be living in a very unconscious way, really, and I'd be kind of going through the motions, still be doing the same old thing, same routine in my life. But now I consider things very, very differently, and you know, I really do appreciate all that I do have in my life, you know, and I think just life is great. So
It's definitely a gift, isn't it? I think life is like an infinite number of freeways, and you can just get shifted, and you don't need to just take that one freeway, you know.
That's
so you've gone on another angle and a totally different direction, and now look, it's amazing. People, it's incredible what you're doing, and so I think maybe you believe as well that this is what you're here to do.
Yeah, I think so. Yes, absolutely.
It's
From the
your
time I
mission.
committed, yeah, as soon as I committed to doing that research, everything just kind of changed. And the way the research came about, it just as if someone had rolled out a red carpet for me, and all I had to do was walk across it. It was incredible.
Yeah.
And even though it was, it was really time consuming and it took up a lot of my time and it was hard work, it was like doing a hobby, I never perceived it as being hard work at all. It was just something that I was genuinely fascinated by and motivated to learn more about.
Well, you do that, Penny,
Maybe
don't
you're an
you?
old soul.
Yeah,
You're an old
you
soul.
well, you come back again. I mean, you do that, don't you, Penny? A lot of people, they live their whole lives, they just get married and they do that factory job or they do this job. But their whole lives, there's that splinter in the mind. There's something there that you need to do, but you don't know what it is. It's like,
Yes.
what do I? Well, there's something I need to do on this planet, but I don't know what it is. And I feel like Garth and I are beginning to do it. I was sort of on that road, and now I'm doing this, talking to you, and you're doing what you do. And I feel like it's like throwing a pebble into a still lake. And it just sets off that ripple effect, and I feel like I'm on this path now, and talking to all these amazing people. I feel like you must feel like the same, that you were gone in to be a nurse, and then, bang! It's just this ricochet effect. You've noticed how what's happening, and now you're off on this journey. So this is where you're meant to be. So it's a great positive thing indeed. So it's fantastic, and thanks for talking to Garth and I on our
Oh, thanks.
podcast. It's great having you.
Oh, it's been really great. Thank you very much, guys. It's been excellent.
Okay, and I'll send you the link after it's uploaded, and we hope to speak to you again sometime in the near future, and please take care and keep researching and doing the great work that you are
Yeah, same to you
doing.
guys as well. Thank
All the
you.
best, Penny. All the best.
Okay, thanks.
Take
Thank
care.
you.
Okay, bye.
Okay, bye.
Yeah, it's true, Garth. I